أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، وبه نستعين، إنه خير ناصر ومعين. ولا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم. ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين وخاتم النبيين وسيد المرسلين أبي القاسم محمد. وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين، لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين. السلام على الحسين وعلى علي بن الحسين وعلى أولاد الحسين وعلى أصحاب الحسين. My respected elders, brothers, sisters in Islam and Iman, Salamun alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. On this evening, I'd like to first begin by thanking Allah for the opportunity to gather together for His sake to further our commitment to the cause of His deen and the cause of the Imam of our time. And I'd like us to remember all of those who are in need of our prayers on this evening, all those who are oppressed, all those who are traveling, all the pilgrims and the zuwar, and especially the Imam of our time, who we are commanded to pray for and to remember and to pray for his safety and to pray for his reappearance and his swift reappearance, and that we may be among those who deserve to be among his ranks. So for all those du'as to be accepted and for these efforts to be accepted, please say aloud salawat. The topic that we've been looking at over the course of the evenings has been the practical advice of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim wassalam when it comes to living in a non-Muslim environment. The topic that we began to address yesterday evening had to do with instilling the love of the deen and a desire to worship and to pray in the next generation. And yesterday I lay out some fundamental principles when it came to the Islamic instructions in this regard, along with examples about how to apply these principles. What I'd like to do tonight, inshallah, is to complete that discussion. I didn't get a chance to present all the points that I had prepared in regards to that yesterday evening. And inshallah, we'll complete that discussion, at least for now, and then begin the next part, the next sort of area of focus that we have from the Ahlul Bayt in this regard. As you remember, we last night began to explore the responsibilities that we have towards raising children. And one of the things that perhaps for some of us was new was this idea that a good child, especially a child who's young, less than 7 years old, isn't necessarily a child who is calm and docile and just does everything that they're told. And this is something that we have to understand and appreciate that sometimes what we've been taught and what we imagine to be good and right may not be aligned with Islamic teachings. Islamically speaking, it may be a case that a child is calm and they're a very good child, and they will be a good child. And it may be the case that a child is quite wild and quite robust, to put it maybe a little bit nicer, and they'll be a great child as well. They say that Imam Khomeini rahmatullahi alayhi, one time they complained about his son. And they said that, you know, his son was like a child and he was running around everywhere and making a big mess and basically turning the place upside down. So they come to him and they complain. They say that your son is too much to handle. Can you do something about it? So he tells them that, no, just leave him. When I was his age, I was worse than he was. I used to be even more wild than he was. Now that individual, imagine a kid like that, a child like that, can grow up and do the things that he did, achieve the level of knowledge and practice and proximity to Allah that he did. So I just use that as an example just to help us understand that perhaps the benchmarks that we're using need to be revised in some cases. When it comes to looking at how we're supposed to raise our children, one of the key themes that we covered last night is this idea that our children go through stages. It's not just children who go through stages, brothers and sisters. We too, all of us are going through different stages of life. Allah says in Surah Nuh, Surah number 71, verses 13 and 14, مَالَكُمْ لَا تَرْجُونَ لِلَّهِ وَقَارَ وَقَدْ خَلَقَكُمْ أَطْوَارَ. What is the matter with you? Why don't you give your Lord, why don't you give Allah more veneration, appreciate Him more and His position more and the role He plays in your life even more than you do? Why? What's the reason? وَقَدْ خَلَقَكُمْ أَطْوَارَ. He has created you and causes you to go through various stages. A couple of lessons we can take from that is that all of us go through different stages in life. Whether we like it or not, we are in a journey, one after the other. And number two, we're not alone in that journey. Our Lord is the one who is taking us through them. He is the one who created these different stages. In riwayat, we're told that there's a stage that a human being reaches when he or she is 33 years old. And that stage is known as balagha ashudda. That's when they reach the point of maturity. And that stage continues until the age of 40. And then at 40 years, that's when things start to go downhill from there. Meaning they reach maturity and then they go downhill. Now, we put this all together. What does it mean? Does it mean that we need to be depressed about this idea that we're going through stages, we're marching towards, we're getting more and more mature, and eventually we're getting to the point where we're actually leaving as well too? Not at all, because the Islamic perspective is a beautiful perspective. It's a perspective which says that along the way, all these stages that we go through aren't just stages on a physical level. The physical changes that we go through are part of the preliminary process which is necessary to mold our soul. And our soul is going to last even beyond our body lasts. And this is the beauty about the Islamic perspective on tarbiyah, that what we're working with is not just a body, it's a soul. And we're not alone in that process either. As I'm dealing with my child and I'm working with him, I should understand that I am just one cause among a whole host of causes that the Lord, the Rabb, has put into place in order to raise my child. And those of you who are parents will sympathize with that. You'll know that, you'll realize that how little it is that we do and how much of it that is done for us. We just have to learn what our part is, make sure that we do that the best way we can do possible, and leave the rest to Allah. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Now, I explained last night that according to traditions, we have a number of traditions which talk about three stages. it's not just three stages that a child goes through or a human being goes through. As I mentioned right now, there's another stage, for example, from 33 to 40, and other riwayat as well too that mention what happens at 50, what happens at 60, what happens before that, after that. But three of the key salient stages that a human being will go through, a particular child, is at the age of 7, 14, and 21. So these, it's good for us to focus on this, but we should know that it's not just limited to that. And it is the case that these are just given as guidelines. It's not the case that exactly at 7 and 14 things will suddenly change, as we mentioned. It's something that will be a natural progress and natural process that will take place. I mentioned last night that in that first stage of 0 to 7, this is the stage when a child is not capable of taking orders from their parents. And some of the things that we can do during this time when it comes to fostering that spirit of the deen with them, in them, is to, I mentioned talking about the universal principles, tawheed, these type of things. One of the things that we can do is make sure that we frequently tell them stories. All of us, maybe we don't know how to tell a story, maybe we're not good at it. Okay, fine, we can get a book and we can learn how to do it. It's a skill that can be acquired, just like the other many skills that we've done. If I'm an older child, I have a younger sibling, one of the best things I can do for my brother or sister is to tell them stories. Islamic stories, stories of the prophets, stories of the imams, these are things which naturally appeal to the fitrah of any child. But even other than that, stories of life, stories where there's good lessons to learn. And we don't have to go and talk in great detail about, oh, and now the moral of the story is this and this and this and this and this. No. Children are very smart. They pick up on these things. Even if we tell a story and just make one subtle reference to the moral and then jump back into the story, that will stick with the children many, many months or even years later on. Now, sometimes when people hear this idea of, as we talked about last night, of having this parenting style, which is one where we appreciate the freedom and that sense of independence of a child, they get a little bit worried. Some of the common questions that are asked, I want to address briefly and then move on to the second and third stage. One of them is the following. They say that, okay, does that mean that in the first 7 years we're going to allow them to be independent? Does that mean that basically we let them be free? We don't have any responsibility. Is it just totally hands-off parenting? The child is just doing whatever they want all the time and we're free? No. Actually, the responsibility of a parent during this time is incredible. It's very important that a parent is very directly involved in raising the child. But how do they do so? They do so in an indirect sort of way, meaning they're stepping back and they're not directly ordering and commanding and prohibiting the child. But they're creating that environment. They're setting that pace and that tone so that the children will indirectly be guided as to what they have to do. So this is important to understand. It's not the same as just being free completely. And it's not the same as just letting them be wild and do anything they want at any time. A child at that age will naturally want to be free and independent and make their own decisions and do their own things. But sometimes it will be the case that they act out of place. Now in this circumstance right here, what do we do? For example, my child has done something like has hit another child. Or they've done something inappropriate and they knew that and they did that. What is our response supposed to be? The easy response is to punish. The easy response is to ground. The easy response is to give time out. But this, we need to resist that easy approach and look at it a little bit more complex, in a complex sort of way, sophisticated. We have to learn as parents the process of identifying the cause behind why our children are acting in a certain way. One of the things we have to remember is that children do not willfully act badly. They don't decide that I'm going to act like a rebel. I'm going to be a bad child right now. That's not the way children are. there's always a reason for why they act the way that they act. Now, what could that reason be? This is the job of a parent to figure out. Could it be the case that my child isn't fed properly, has not slept properly, and this is what's causing them to act in this way? Could it be the case that my child hasn't played properly? One of the things that we, living in this society especially, need to do is make sure that we give our children a chance to play. I don't mean just playing on the Xbox or playing on the Nintendo Wii or whatever it may be. All right, playing the way that it used to be done, where you go to a playground and you run around and you get all that energy around. And we have to go with them and run with them, race with them, go up and down and jump up and down with them. Get them to get used to this idea of using playground as a way and play as a way of getting that energy out of the body. If we don't do that, then we start to see the repercussions. We start to see that they have this energy and they take it out in ways that makes them difficult and troublesome to deal with. Peace and salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Now let's say that it comes to a point where we decide that our child, we've tried different approaches, indirect approaches, showing love, using different techniques, identifying the root problem, but we still decide that our child has to be punished for what they've done. Now, how do we go about doing so? Punishment should only be the last resort. There is a room for it, but it should be done in a very mild sort of way, especially at this age, at the young age, in the first stage. It should be a very temporary sort of thing, a temporary demonstration of a loss of a privilege or a lack of communication, but not in any way that makes the child feel that they have lost the love of the parent. Sometimes we get in the habit and we say that, you know, what you did, we say like that's a very bad thing. We use words like bad. Or sometimes we go and we actually make them feel bad and destroy their personality for what they've done. How could you ever do that thing? I never expected you to do that, such a thing like that. These type of approaches in the long run will not be fruitful, because we don't ever want to destroy the personality and the confidence of our child in front of us. We never want them to fear us as parents. They should always understand that we're on their side, because we are on their side. After all, do we want our children to be good for us, for our sake, so that we can show other people that my children are so good and they behave so well? That's not my goal in raising children. I want them to be good for their sake, in the way that Allah has created them and fulfilling the role that He has put for me in terms of being able to raise them. One more salawat, please. Now, let's say that as a parent for years now, my child is, let's say, 5 years old. Until now, I've taken a typical classical approach of raising my children, that they have to be in line. They're like my foot soldiers and I'm the commander, and I set the tone and the instructions for the day, and they have to fall into line or else they're going to get punished. But now I come to understand that, okay, there's a different approach that Islam is giving us, the Ahlul Bayt have given us. What do I do in this situation? Is it just too late? The experts in this area say that no, it's not too late. As long as we're within that first 7 years, then it's okay. At this point, you've realized it. At this point, you need to switch your techniques, switch your strategies. And even though it may be difficult at first, because the child is used to something and suddenly you're going to be holding off where you used to be very hard and very, very harsh and cracking down, it's going to be different. But after a period of adjustment, things will fall into line. And inshallah, from then on, we can apply these teachings of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. Now the same question applies now. Let's move on to stage number two. As we learned yesterday, stage number two is where the child becomes the abd. Okay, now let's say that until now, I haven't followed these techniques. My child is above 7 years old, and now I wish to apply these techniques. What do I do? See, brothers and sisters, here's the issue, that if we don't give our children the proper independence in the first 7 years, we're going to see the consequences in the second 7 years. the typical teenage rebellion that often is seen is a result of this point right here. That they didn't get that rebellious spirit out of them at the right time, so it's not going to show up later in their life. So what do I do? How do I deal with a rebellious teenager? One of the techniques that has been suggested by one of the experts in the area is the following. He says that, look it, it might be the case that your child is wherever they're at and you're wherever you are. But there is a way that you can make your way into the heart of your child. What is that way? Is it through fear? Is it through threatening? Is it through kicking them out of the house? No. It's through becoming their friends. One of the things that we should never ever give up is this idea that we have to be friends with our children. A friendly relationship. And if that's in place, and they feel that love and respect as a result of this friendly relationship, even though in the short term, it may be the case that we don't see results when we suggest things and we remind them of things that are important to them, in the long run, it will pay off. Let's say, God forbid, may Allah protect us from, let's say that I have a child who's already at the age where they should be saying their prayers, but they're not saying their prayers. Or they are saying their prayers, but for example, in the Fajr prayer, they're having some difficulties. What do I do as a parent? What is my responsibility in this situation? Is it the case that I have to crack down maliciously and force it out of my children? I can do that, and I might see some results, but after all, how long is that going to last? It might last while the child's in the home, but what happens when they go outside of the home? Because they were doing it for my sake. They're doing it because of my presence. But there's going to come a time when I'm not going to be there. And I want to be thinking long term. I want to train, raise children that even if nobody's looking over their heads, they themselves, out of their love and responsibility towards Allah, they will say their prayers. So in this situation, I mentioned this because perhaps it's something that comes up, you know, especially in the summer times, commonly for some individuals. What do we do? The advice that's given is that we have to do our Islamic responsibilities on one hand, which is that we have to do Amr bil Ma'aruf and Nahi al Munkar. If it's the case that our children are repeatedly making their prayer qada, then we have to bring it to their attention. We have to tell them and order them that this is what they have to do. But the way that we do it has to be the right way of doing it. If it's the case that we're causing them trouble and we're actually like making them displeased by waking them up for the prayers, then it becomes questionable. Because one of the things that we can't do is we can't trouble another believer. So in this point, we have to use the approach of invitation. That look it, here's something that's necessary for you to do. It's expected of you. And these are the benefits of doing so. These are the commandments. This is how important it is. I'm doing it. I'm willing to wake you up for it. I'm going to come into your room, I'm going to call your name, and I want you to do it. And I will really appreciate that as well too, because I myself am hurt when you don't do it. But I'm not going to force you to do it. I'm not going to cut you off if you don't do it. Because I love you, and I have that relationship with you, and I respect you as well too. I want this from you, but I'm not going to force it out of you. And usually, if we take that approach in the long run, we might not see immediate results, but in the long run, it will show results. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Now, the second age group, 7 to 14, first of all, what happens? Is it the case that at age 7 itself, now we have to switch our parenting techniques right when they turn 7 years old? No. What we need to do as parents is we need to be monitoring and being aware of the situation of our children. If we do so, we ourselves will see that they are going through different stages, and particularly at the age of around 7, might happen at 6, it might happen at 8, might happen at 9, they go through a profound transformation. This happens. Let me give you an example from my own experiences. One of the things that we would love our children to do is to be able to read the Quran. Right, all of us like that, and we want that. Now, when do we start to teach them how to read the alphabet and the letters and the Quran? Usually, We just go by whatever is out there, whatever standards are out, whatever the teachers teach them, that sort of thing. And sometimes we see that, you know, so-and-so's daughter or son is already reading. Maybe I feel pressure, I need to teach my child to read as well. But one thing that we'll notice is that there's a certain age at which our child is capable of learning how to read the Arabic alphabet and to read Quran. But making them do so is an act which involves forcing them. They don't really want it. They're capable of doing it, but they don't really have that inclination to do it. Yes, if we force them, then we can make them. But they don't really want it. Now at this point, if we just wait it out a bit, let Allah do His work with our child, we'll realize that there'll come a point where they mature enough, where at this point they're capable of doing it and they actually want to do it as well too. And the job becomes so much simpler at this age. This is the way our children are. The same thing with this very big transition from 0 to 7 to 7 to 14. There comes a point when that child, who before was insistent on being independent, suddenly is looking for guidance. They need to be directed in their lives, and this is where we step forward and we start to instruct our child about life and about how to live a successful life. Does it mean that we now become people who just bark out orders because now the child is the slave and we're the master? No, that's not what's intended by the hadith. It means that we are taking a leadership role. We're directly advising and pointing out to our children that these are the steps that you need to take in life in order to be successful. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. In this stage, this is where the focus is on education, teaching the principles, teaching the deen, teaching the ahkam, teaching the details of the akhlaq as well too. One of the very important points to observe at this second stage is that when we get into issues where we have disagreements with our children, this is an opportunity for us to train our children. We shouldn't see a disagreement as being something bad, but rather as an opportunity. What I mean by this is that our children at this point will have developed their intellect. There will come times when they have their own opinion on what to do, which differs from our own opinion. Now, at this point, we have one of two options. Either we can override whatever they want to say and just enforce our viewpoint and just say, this is the way it has to be done. Or we can take the opportunity to have a discussion. And on a rational level, to present some of our arguments and to hear them out as well too. For example, let's say that our child really at this age, in the second age, really wants to buy something. They insist on it. Okay, we don't want them to buy that. We know that it's not good for them, but they want to buy it. So what we can do is tell them, okay, if you want to buy it, I want you to give me three good reasons. Not just any reason. Good reasons for why you want to buy it. I'll consider them. We'll discuss it. Your mom and dad will discuss it. And then we'll get back to you. Have them think. Challenge them. Usually, if it's something which you've determined to be bad and not good for them, they're not going to be able to come up with those reasons. But in the process, you've given them confidence and you've taught them how to think and rationalize about things. And sometimes we may realize that we're the ones who's making a mistake. They actually have a good reason for pushing forward the thing they want to push forward. And we have to be willing to step aside and say that, you know what? You're right. I did make a mistake in the situation. Sallallahu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Now, it might be the case that in discussions with our children that we find that the dialogue and the conversation gets a little bit intense, and at times we get a little bit frustrated. Usually these types of conversations go into being full-blown arguments. This is something that we need to completely avoid when it comes to our relationship with our children, and even with our spouses as well too. There is no need to ever get into full-blown arguments with fellow mu'mineen. Fellow mu'mineen, the Quran tells us, have to be ruhama'u baynahum. That's a guiding principle. We have to always be compassionate and merciful with each other. Where does a full-blown argument have a place in a relationship which is defined by compassion and mercy? whether it be our children, whether it be our spouses, whether it be our parents, there's no room for these type of heated arguments. If we ever sense that that happens and things are picking up, the volume's getting a little bit louder, that's the point where we just put the brakes on the situation. Pause. Press the pause button. Pause. Okay, at this point, I want you to think about what I've said. I'm going to think about what you said. And we don't have to make a decision just right now. Later on, we'll come back to this. Imagine what we've saved by doing so. Because you know what happens when the temper flares, then things are said and we lose control. The aql is put aside and the ghadab takes full force and we start to bark out things, and later on, only later on, do we realize the damage that we caused through our anger. Brothers and sisters, the third age group is that where, according to some traditions, we're told that we are to take our children as a wazir, as an advisor. Now, does this mean that at this point now, every decision that we make, it's no longer the father and the mother, it's the father, the mother, and the daughter, or the father, mother, and the son? There's the trio that makes the decisions of the family, everything? No. What we can infer from this is that at this point, the child who's been developed and trained and taught these principles, at this point in this third stage, they are now ready to start taking on some serious responsibility. And one of those responsibilities is giving their opinion on what it is that should be done. So once in a while, as a parent, I'm going to consult with my child who's at that age and ask their opinion on something. And one of the sweetest things for a child, if we've gone through the right steps, is to realize that their parents are looking to them to see what they think about something. This is something which can give them a world of confidence. That, hey, okay, so my parents actually care about how I analyze and think about things. This is the age where we start giving them small tasks and responsibilities. After all, we're living in a society, brothers and sisters, where early marriage is a necessity. Right? It's not something, we've gone past that point now where we say that, oh, it's good to consider getting married at a younger age than maybe what other people are doing in the society out there. No, for the most part, let's just be brutally honest about the situation. If you want to, for the most part, if you want to remain pure and not violate the command of God, early marriage is a necessity. And I'm speaking on based on anecdotal evidence and experiences in interacting with the youth. If we want our child to get married at a young age and preserve their faith by means of doing so, what that means is they have to become mature at a younger age. We need to train them like that. Because one of the biggest problems that we have with early marriages is when they happen for the right intentions, but the proper training hasn't taken place to make the two parties mature enough so they can lead a married life. So this is very important. Our children become adults at age of 9 and at the age of 13, 14, or 15. The society might say they become adults at the age of 16 or 18 or 21, depending on which country you are in or what you're talking about. But the deen says it's at the age of 9, at the age of 13, 14, 15, depending on when somebody enters the age of bulugh. So what that means is that we have to treat our children like adults according to our standards. From that age group in particular, 14 to 21, we have to start giving them responsibility, letting them feel what it's like to be independent. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Okay, once again, now in concluding this particular discussion, right, as a reminder to myself and all of you, at the end of the day, it goes back down to us as individuals. If we want to affect others, we have to first be effective on ourselves. We began this discussion using salat as a use case, as an example. I hinted at this yesterday, I didn't get a chance to finish this, that the best way of having our children perform salat in the right way is for us to do it the right way. Meaning that at the first time, awwal waqt, we have a ceremony of prayer in the home and everyone comes together. The husband, the wife, the children in the same place. If we have a special prayer room, then that's great. If we don't, then wherever it is, but there is a place set aside for that. We have the adhan being recited. Not only that, brothers and sisters, we as parents have to set the right environment in the home. We have to show our children that people who do namaz, who do their salat and give importance, this is how they act as a result. It should never be the case that the way we talk about people is different in public than in private. At home, when nobody is there, we start taking this individual and pointing out their faults, and this individual and pointing out their faults. Or maybe we don't do it to that, but we give negative sort of vibes about different people and institutions when we're in the privacy of our home. And that's what our children see. Well, if they see that, then fitratan, from the perspective of fitrah, they're going to be turned away from those acts which lead us to talk about people like this. Particularly controlling our temper makes a huge difference in terms of being able to influence our children when it comes to our akhlaq. The respect that we give to one another in home. These are basic things, but we need to be reminded about them. Sometimes when we're in our comfort zone, right, we kick off our shoes and we kind of, you know, go to our couch and lie down. We put aside our shoes, we put aside our coat, we also put aside our akhlaq as well. That respect that we might show our co-workers and our fellow masjid goers and center goers isn't shown to fellow members of the household at home. Whereas the seerah that we have from the imams and the students of the imams in our ulama is that they would show the utmost respect to their family members. In particular, the husband to the wife and the wife to the husband. The great ones. Go and read the biographies of the great ones. Allama Tabataba, Imam. Pick your favorite one. Allama Tabataba, Imam Khomeini, Ayatollah Behjad, whoever it is. And look and see what they write about how they used to interact with their spouses. Sometimes it puts us to shame. That this is the way it's supposed to be and this is the way that we are. This has a huge impact on our children. And finally, if they see that we are individuals who observe the religion, if we stay away from that which is haram, anything which is considered negative from the perspective of deen, then that itself is the best way for them to adopt and love and practice the deen. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Okay, now I want to give a story just as an example here. And this is sort of in transition and leading us to the next point. I'm just going to introduce the topic for tomorrow, inshallah, and we'll go into in detail tomorrow. There's a story of a great individual who was able to instill the love of prayer in his son. And this is something which I personally found very inspiring. I'd like to share with you tonight. It's a story of a scholar named Kashif al-Ghita. Kashif al-Ghita, Sheikh Kashif al-Ghita, is somebody who is considered to be like a very powerful scholar of Shia scholarship. Even Sheikh Ansari, in his works, in his fiqh works, whenever he comes to analyzing the opinion of Sheikh Kashif al-Ghita, most of the times he just quotes it without even trying to refute it. And when he introduces him, he says that this is the pillar of Islam, you know, that Sheikh of Sheikhs who says the following thing. And this is Sheikh Ansari, who himself was, you know, Sheikh al-A'zam. Sheikh Kashif al-Ghita was somebody who was renowned for his ibadah, and he had an extremely good relationship with his children as well too. They asked his son, how is it that your father taught you to love prayer? And he says this following story. He says that one day, I was a child, and my father woke me up, and it was time for Salatul Layl. It wasn't time for Salatul Fajr, it was time for Salatul Layl, Namaz al-Shab. He wakes me up and he says, okay, get up, we're going to the Haram of Imam Ali alayhi salam, and we're going to do our Fajr prayers over there. Now, this is a child, right? And, you know, he's sleepy, so he says that, oh no, I'm just going to go to sleep, you know, thank you, but no thank you, okay? Now, don't get me wrong here, I'm not saying that this is the approach we should take immediately, because he's obviously been working on his child, he's done these things that we're talking about, now he wants to take his child to another level. He wakes him up, and then, you know, he sort of, once more he wakes him up, and finally his son comes out of bed, you know, does wudu, and then they set off. Now on the way, as they're going to the haram, they pass a beggar. And he notices and sees this beggar who's begging at that time of the morning, anybody who's walking by, going to the masjid, he's begging from them. they go and they say their prayers, right? And afterwards they come back again and he's talking to his son. And he asks him a question. He said, you saw that beggar who was sitting there? He says, yeah. He said that, why do you think he's sitting there? He's sitting there because obviously he's hopeful that he's going to get money from people who are walking by. He says, how much do you think he's going to get? He says, well, we're not sure, but maybe he'll get X amount from all the people who are going to walk by. So he says that, so the father, Kashyapa, he says that, so you see here that this beggar, on just a probability that he's going to get some donations and charity, he's out there at that time of the morning sitting there and begging from passerbys. Now you have a Lord who is promising you with a promise which is certain, that if you are up at this time and you are worshipping him, فَلَا يَعْلَمُ نَفْسٌ مَا أُخْفِيَتْ لَهُمْ مِنْ قُرَّةِ أَعْيُنٍ جَزَاءً بِمَا كَانُوا يَعْمَلُونَ, that no soul can even understand and comprehend what is waiting for them in reward and compensation for the Salatul Layl that they have performed. This is what the Quran tells us. That's it. And then he goes along. Imagine the powerful lesson that a parent can teach their child about Allah, about ibadah, by themselves being people like this, by seeing God in the world around them, and by talking this and conveying this to their children. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. The question I would leave with this with you tonight, I was hoping to actually get into the tradition for tonight, but it seems that we don't have too much time. Anyhow, I just want to leave you with the question, which is that we've been talking about raising children for the last two nights, and certain guidelines that are there, which are simple but have profound effects. And inshallah, we're inspired to work on them because after all, we love our children, we want the best of them. But all these discussions, they all come back to one axis, one pivotal point, which is that what are we doing for ourselves and our relationship with Allah? If there's guidelines for how to raise our children, aren't there guidelines for us as individuals? Where are we when it comes to our relationship with Allah? We hear of these stories, and sometimes we feel so divorced from them. I feel emptiness when it comes to my relationship with Allah. I say my prayers, but I don't have any feeling behind it. In the month of Ramadan, I might feel something, but afterwards I just feel dry inside. I'm just going through the motions. I'm looking for some connection and some spark, but I'm not finding it. What's going on? We hear about these stories. Another story for you. There was this one Sayyid named Sayyid Shifti. And he was somebody who lived in Isfahan. He was a great scholar. There's a lot of great stories about him. He's considered like one of the Urafa. They say that one day, one of the people, like what used to happen in Isfahan, is that, this is the old days, they didn't used to have like bathrooms at home. People used to have to go to the public bath, the hammam, where they have to wash themselves there. Now people used to sleep early and they used to wake up early. They would wake up 2 hours before the Fajr prayer, and they would make their way to the bath, and that would be kind of like a social gathering for them as well too. 2 hours later, at the Fajr time, they would head back home. Now one of the people reports, he says that, I walked by Sayyid Shifti's home. Now Sayyid Shifti was known as an abid, a worshipper of God. He had love of worship. And he says that, I just heard this crying and this wailing from the door of this scholar. And I paused to just hear what he was saying. It seemed like he was repeating this line again and again and again. What was this line? Ilahi, ayukhayyibu mithluka mithli. So beautiful, so beautiful. This line, when I heard this, I heard this story years and years ago, but sometimes you hear something and it sticks with you. It's, oh my God, would someone like you disappoint somebody like me? Ayukhayyibu mithluka mithli. Again and again and again he's repeating it with tears, with the burning of the heart, with passion, with desire. He says, I went off to the hammam. I came back 2 hours later and I once again heard him crying out and praying, I passed by, I paused, and I heard him repeating the same line 2 hours later. Now, if it's up to us, we might say that, okay, once or twice, okay, fine. You know, 10 times, 20 times, okay. But beyond that, you know, we don't really have that desire even. So what is it that's wrong with us? Sometimes, one of my teachers gave me this tip once. He said that we do roza, we do masaib of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, but sometimes we need to do masaib for ourselves and ask ourselves, what is wrong with us? What do we need to do? Aren't there some things that we can do to create that passion and create that spark? And he repeated this line from Dua Abi Hamza Thumali, where he said that, O Allah, khayruka ilayna nazil wa sharruna ilayka sa'id. This is the pattern that, O Allah, you keep on blessing us with blessing after blessing after blessing, but we respond with ungratitude after ungratitude after ungratitude. And you can do a whole masaib after and thinking about this and realizing this. I'd like us to think about this and see, isn't it the case that the same way there's guidelines for raising children, there's guidelines for raising ourselves as well too? Are we in natural states when we don't feel any connection, any spark with Allah, and we have to wait for only the month of Ramadan or maybe Ashura to feel that spark? Isn't there something we could do to fix this? Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Tonight, I would like to, inshallah, continue the story of what took place to the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam in Sham. One of the things we have to realize, brothers and sisters, is that this particular scene is unparalleled for the Ahlul Bayt in terms of something that was difficult to bear. They had seen so much martyrdom, so much death, so much sacrifice, so many difficult times. So many cities, from Medina to Mecca to Kufa to Karbala, back to Kufa. But of all the places, there's one place which stands out in being particularly difficult. When they ask Imam Sajjad, what was the most difficult event for you to bear in all of that tragedy? He repeats three times, Asham, Asham, Asham. I myself cannot imagine that scene where the Ahlul Bayt of the Prophet, those that Allah had purified, are standing there in the court of Yazid with chains around them. A chain is surrounding and is binding together the young daughters of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. What kind of situation is this? But in this situation we see that the Imam of that time, Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam, that he performs his responsibility in such a beautiful way to convey the message of Karbala to the people. History reports to us that when Yazid begins to insult them, Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam asks him, he says that, will you permit me to ascend the pulpit and speak to the people? Yazid is so intoxicated with his power that he agrees. Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam begins his speech. He says, Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. People's attention is captured by this young man who is speaking so eloquently. Who is he and what is it that he has to say? This young man begins to speak to them. He says, Ayyuhan nas, man arafani faqad arafani. O people, whoever knows me, they know me. But whoever, man dhalladhi lam ya'arifuni, fa inni u'arifuni bihasabi wa nasabi. Whoever doesn't know me, I'm going to introduce myself by telling you from which progeny and lineage I come from. Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam begins to introduce himself. He is no stranger to them. Anabnun Nabiyyil Mustafa. You know that prophet that you claim that you adhere to, that you follow? I am his descendant. They begin to realize that this is not an ordinary group of prisoners. This is from the family of the prophet. But from which family of the prophet? أنا ابن علي المرتضى، أنا ابن فاطمة الزهراء. He identifies him further. He says, I am the son of Ali and I am the son of Fatima. Now they start to understand that these prisoners are from the direct descendants of the Prophet, from the direct descendants of the daughter of the Prophet and Imam Ali alayhi salam. أنا ابن من دنا فتدلى فقاب قوسين أو أدنى. That Prophet who performed the Mi'raj and attained that proximity to Allah, I am his son, I am his grandson. But still the question lingers in their mind, which grandson is this? Who is this noble man who is speaking with so much emotion and passion and who's calling their attention to him? He goes on to say, أنا ابن الحسين الشهيد بكربلا. I am the son of that Hussein who became shaheed in Karbala. I am the son of the one for whom the jinns wept in the dark and for the whom the birds cried in the air. When the people realize who this is, they begin to cry. Finally, it dawns upon them that these were not ordinary prisoners. This was the family of the Prophet. A revolt is about to take place. Yazid is worried. He calls for the adhan to be read. They begin reciting the adhan. Imam Zain al-Abidin remains quiet. Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah. Finally, the adhan says, Ashhadu anna Muhammadar Rasulullah. Imam Sajjad alayhi salam seizes the opportunity. He cries out, he says that this messenger that you are bearing testament that he is the messenger of Allah, I am his grandson. Why did you kill my father as you did? As-salamu alayka ya Aba Abdullah. As-salamu alayka وعلى ابنك علي الأكبر. Tonight I'd like to mention just a few words about another son of Imam Hussein. In the court of Sham, some were at least willing to give some respect to Ali, the son of Hussein, Zainul Abideen. But on the plains of Karbala, when Ali Akbar alayhi salam is standing in front of the enemy, they'd show no such respect. Ali Akbar cries out, Ana Ali ibn al-Husayn ibn Ali. If you don't know me, then I am Ali, the son of Hussein, the son of Ali. I'm going to defend my father against you. They say that of all the people, Ali Akbar alayhi salam resembled the Prophet in the way he looked, in the way he behaved. But this was no deterrent from them to attack him so brutally. Ali Akbar alayhi salam gets to the point where he becomes fatigued. Only once more he wishes to meet with his father. He wishes to meet the Imam of his time. After all, wouldn't you like to see the Imam of your time before you leave this world? He goes to his father, he tells him, Ya Abati al-Atashu qad katalani. وثقل الحديد قد أجهدني فهل إلى شربة من الماء سبيل. Oh my father, if only there was a way that I could get some water. My thirst is killing me. The armor is so heavy. Imam Hussein alayhi salam knows what awaits his son. He encourages him to fight once more. Ali Akbar once enters the battle again. After some time, the cry is made out, Oh my father, alayka salam. This is my grandfather who is sending his salams to you. He is assuring me that for me there is a cup of water that will quench my thirst and I shall never be thirsty again. Ala la'anatullahi ala al-qawm al-zalimin. وسيعلم الذين ظلموا أي منقلب ينقلبون. مهتم حسين.
يا حسين.